This is White Scar's Team Up. As before, listeners, this is an extra as opposed to a main episode, so spoilers for all of New Century Phase 1 are rife, and we also go into huge detail with some other horror movies, such as two different versions of the Night of the Living Dead film, and a couple others which are listed in the show notes. With that, we deposit you back into the middle of our original conversation. That's what I had immediately in front of me.
Well, there's one. I've still got a few things in front of me. So
yes, go ahead.
So we haven't even got to the main one yet. If you're looking at a horror reference as a touch point for Let Them Go, you can't look further than Night of the Living Dead. It's almost beat for beat.
Right. You mentioned that when approached you.
One of the things I was most, what Alex did so well, impressed with, is that he basically takes... The Night of the Living Dead framework has been done many, many times. Mm. And because of that framework, I really expected New Century moving forward to be essentially a zombie narrative. Especially when you read Cartographer's Handbook next, which is obviously influenced by World War Z, the Frank Brooks one, things like that. But his monsters are far more complicated than that. And it's seeded very, very early on. They're not just monsters. When I was reading, when I was listening to Let Them Go over the last couple of days, I actually wrote in my notes, they're not zombies, they're wolves. Mm. And then maybe an hour later, he actually describes them as wolves, hence the yellow eyes. They're not just zombies, they're not just monsters. They have feelings, they have emotions, they have wants and needs and ambitions. They're not just mindless killing machine monsters. And that's almost a twist for me, the most obvious one. Have you guys seen Night of the Living Dead at all?
Yes, I have.
I have not. The closest I have come was the big... I want to say quad tick or just the entire oeuvre of the Living Dead genre that Alex and Sharon did a while back, where they covered all the way from Night of the Living Dead to the most recent remake, I think, of, was it Day of the Dead or Dawn of the Dead?
Yeah, Zack Snyder's best, possibly only really good film is that remake he did of Dawn of the Dead. Was it Dawn of the Dead or Day of the Dead he did? But the original Night of the Living Dead, I actually prefer the remake that he remade his own film. Romero, because he'd lost the rights through a loophole to the original Night of the Living Dead, he had a remake in 1990, which is pretty much the same film, but the ending changed in a way that's very relevant, I think, and more in keeping with Let Them Go. So, obviously, the Night of the Living Dead story, sorry for spoilers if anyone hasn't seen it, but it's been around for a long time, you need to catch up. You've got a couple driving in a car, and for various reasons they end up running to a farmhouse, and they barricade themselves in the farmhouse with the dead outside. They find a family hiding in the house that already lived there, and you have various archetypes in that house that show up in all the remakes and all the versions. And to a certain extent, those archetypes are there in Let Them Go as well, but they're twisted and played with. There's no way it's done by accident. So in Night of the Living Dead, you've got a chap called Harry, and he's the Dawson. He's argumentative. He thinks he's above it all. He's weak. He's scared. He's unable to cope. He recommends just barricading and waiting until morning. He's essentially the same character as Dawson. And you've got the young feminine hero, who's this lady called Barbara, who was in the car in the first place. You've got a daughter called Sarah from the family in the house, and she's been bitten and is slowly turning, much like Amanda in Let Them Go. And then you've got Ben, who's it's very famously a black guy. It was quite groundbreaking at the time when they lost the film. He's able, he's resourceful, he's strong, he's clever. Very much like Rafe, yeah. And it's not by accident that these same sort of character types are in Let Them Go. I don't think it's by accident at all. I just think that Alex twists and plays with these archetypes so that it catches you off guard, such as in the original Night of the Living Dead, Ben is Rafe. So when suddenly you take him away in the first act, you're like, whoa, hang on, where did that come from? It completely throws you. In the original movie, the movie ends with Ben. Ben's the sole survivor. He hides in the basement. And then the next day, the military, the army show up, kill all the zombies to save the day. And yay, go team, go America. And Ben comes out of the cellar to go, thanks for rescuing me. And they just shoot him, thinking he's a zombie, and throw him on the fire with the other corpses. And it's basically that they assumed, because they saw he was a black guy, they didn't take any time to think, they just killed him. So the original Night of the Living Dead was like a race comment.
This was originally recorded prior to the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and the protests that grew out of these crimes committed by law enforcement, as well as the many other black men and women killed by cops all over the U.S. since Ferguson and before. I removed the clip of me, Riley, commenting on it, as I don't want anyone thinking that I take this sort of thing lightly.
And it's basically suggesting that if he'd have been a white man coming out of the cellar saying, thanks for saving me, they wouldn't have shot him. But then the remake, which I think is more relevant to Let Them Go. And when you Google this, not many people talk about how they changed the ending. And in the original ending, Barbara, who is the kind of the Rebecca of the story, she dies. And Ben goes to hide in the cellar and survives. In the remake, the Romero remade his own film in 1990. He changes it in the sense that you think, I'm going to call her Rebecca, but her name's Barbara. You think she's died, but actually she gets away.
Okay.
And she comes back. And because she gets away, when the soldiers turn up the next day, having seen the original, you're thinking, yes, they're not going to shoot him this time, because she's going to say, don't worry, he's with me. And she's with the soldiers. And instead, when they open the door, it turns out Ben must have got bitten before he goes down there, and he comes out the cellar already as a zombie, and they throw him on the pile. But I find it very interesting that in Romero remaking his own Night of the Living Dead film, essentially for reasons of rights and sort of money, he changed the ending to make it from a black empowerment tale to a female empowerment film. The parallels with Night of the Living Dead, the original, not the whole franchise, the original, and Let Them Go are very strong.
Mm.
Just to finish off the remake, the second ending, Ben comes out the cellar, he's already a zombie, and your hopes are dashed. And then the Dawson figure, this chap called Harry, he comes down from the attic, and it turns out that he survived the whole thing. He's basically sold everyone out, ran upstairs and hidden in the attic. And Barbara takes one look at him and says, I found another one, and shoots him dead.
I gotta see this.
It's great. It's really good. So obviously a lot of purists will talk about Night of the Living Dead. I prefer the remake just because the ending is just so much more punch. You get the gut punch of Ben, who's the hero in the original, and you're like, oh, because you thought he's going to survive, and then he dies. And then but Barbara's alive, and then Harry comes out the attic, who's the Dawson figure, and you're like, you bastard, you survived, you snake, you've just literally sold everyone out to save your own skin and cower upstairs. And she takes one look over her shoulder at the soldiers and goes, I found another one, bang. And it's essentially the same note of an ending, of Rebecca ending with, you know, empowerment. Yeah, we're checking out.
Do you think it has that extra punch because of the context of having seen the original, or do you think it would work just as well if you watched it fresh?
I think knowing the original gives it more punch, because when you watch the original, it's a really downbeat ending because he survives and he wins. And then these asshole American soldiers, just as soon as you see a black guy, just shoot him, and it's gutting. I don't like films that finish on a negative. Like I share this opinion with Alex, is that if hope isn't the point, then what's the point of even writing in the first place?
And it has this real sort of downer. I think that's why it's as valuable as it is, because for as much as the rest of the film is, oh, here's all zombie fiction that ever followed, and isn't it amazing to see this, and you get to hear that they're coming to get you, Barbara, so that's a lot of fun. But it's the ending which I think always sticks out to anyone who is watching it fresh, because that's the thing which kind of really hits home in the way that I think the better parts of The Walking Dead, from people who enjoy that series, often talk about it, in the sense of the real monsters aren't the zombies and stuff like that. And I think with that ending, it kind of shows you that this needless death is caused not by the fictional thing we have presented within this narrative. It's caused by something that's very real and very much ongoing, that real people suffering this exact kind of tragedy. And it stays with you, and it's an important message, even though as a story it leaves you in this sort of crestfallen place. So I have mixed feelings on that point.
But the remake left me feeling upbeat, because this lady Barbara wins in the end of the day. It comes down to she's the one that walks away. And I found that very uplifting.
At least someone survives.
Yeah, another thing interesting about the remake, again, it's the original Night of the Living Dead got lots of criticism for the gore content. The remake, very specifically, is not gory. And you can find interviews with Romero when he got so sick of being called the Blood King, the gore monster, all this. And he was being written off as being a one-trick pony that all he did was convincing splatter effects.
Imagine calling Romero like, oh, this guy only does one thing. It's like, yeah, we're going to call this legend of cinema just doing one thing.
Yeah, but it's interesting what you just said, Toby, about this is one of the biggest part of my notes. All the best horror films, including Let Them Go, the monsters are not what you think of the monsters. Like these fictionalized fantasy monsters, like the Wendigo or the zombies or whatever you want to call them in whatever film you're making, same as The Mist, same as Aliens, same as The Shining, same as all pretty much everyone you can think of. The monsters are inside, they're the ones that are in us. And
I think it's what separates the schlock horror that doesn't really have a lot of meaning to it, because it's all sort of a circumstance of, oh, wouldn't it be horrible to be encounters a crazy man with a knife? And it's like, yes, it would. Can you add anything to that? Like, does it make our character feel anything or think about some sort of pre-existing guilt or trauma and it helps them to overcome it? It's like, no, they just get shanked at the end in a surprise twist. Wahey! It's like, great.
Nice use of the word shanks. You don't hear that word often.
And then the movie's just like, well, that's us. Carry on.
We hope you've enjoyed No Moral Theater, ladies and gentlemen. The camera pulls back as if to say, sorry about this, everyone. It's my fault. Sorry.
Jason Voorhees looks at the camera and goes, ain't I a stinker?
Nick, we've had a private conversation about how you feel cathartic endings are better than downbeat endings. I generally agree with that. There are sometimes there are places for downbeat endings, but I definitely prefer the hopeful ending, just as you do, just as Alex does. At this point, because the subject was regarding films with downbeat endings that also had an alternate, more positive ending, I wanted to bring up my favorite example of this, the movie Seven. Seven is one of those complicated movies made more so by the fact that the antagonist is one of those people we don't really like to talk about anymore because of what was revealed about him during the Me Too movement. But after hearing myself explain the two endings to Nick and Toby, I eventually decided to just cut the entire bit. Those of you who know the ending know why it feels in bad taste given current circumstances in the U.S. It's a shame because I don't actually like cutting content from other people, and it should be for clarity, quality, and overall listenability. But as the old saying goes, the personal is political. As a creator, that goes doubly so. I have to make sure that my creative works do the least harm possible and adequately reflect my views. That includes realizing that something I said was a result of privilege clouding my better judgment. The point we're making is this. The world is already full of people making bad decisions out of fear, anger, and despair. Maybe during the 90s, this ending felt like a way to shock the general public out of complacency and show us a truth behind the mask of media propaganda. In 2020, that mask is already ashes. Jordan Peele knew he needed something different back in 2016 when he changed the ending to Get Out. It is better to light a single candle than curse the darkness. That could be Alex's mantra with New Century, and in that, all us white scars stand together.
I like the idea of somebody sacrificing themselves just to maintain the hope. I'm guessing you guys are Dark Knight fans. Like the ending of that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, maybe not.
Oh, I am.
Oh, sorry. The way that noise came out, I was like, oh, are we about to have a debate?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, it sounded like that moment in Eddie Izzard. What's the noise there? You like Nazis? You're not sure?
Yeah, but I mean, obviously Batman ending with falling on the sword for Harvey Dent. It's the same. That's the same kind of thing.
Absolutely. And it's this thing where, to sort of weave it back to Let Them Go, I think that the downer ending the therapeutic process is there in the title, that you know that one of the characters has to do this in order to survive this. I think Rebecca is fighting to survive not just this one night with the Wendigo. She's fighting to make her way through a whole lot more history. At the end, if she sort of shot her sister and took a moment and she was completely numb and she had to go forward as this battle-hardened person who had to fight this frightening world, that would be an ending for certain, but I think that the place it ends is a lot more nuanced and I think reflective of not only who Rebecca is as a character, but the tone that Alex wants to strive for going forward, because by acknowledging that there is at least some part of her sister that she cannot bring herself to remove from this world or believes could still be there. And I think it's almost like this is a lot of interpretation and me inferring this, but the fact that the Wendigo Amanda doesn't actually strike at her shows that she is at least not acting on the animal impulse that the rest of the Wendigos have, and that shows that there is at least something more than just what we see on the surface. And I think that creates this ending, which is bittersweet. It's that lovely cocktail of feelings which acknowledges the dark but maintains that little bit of light that you need to keep taking that next step forward.
Yeah, we're talking about endings here. Nick, I want to hear what you took away from the ending.
From the endings, well, the fact that she doesn't kill Amanda, even the second time round, I find it fascinating, because if Rebecca had killed Amanda, or vice versa, and Amanda kills Rebecca, either way, that is putting a hard close on that loop. That arc is finished, that story is finished. The fact that they both walk away the way they do, it leaves you with the impression that at least one of those arcs is not done.
Mm.
And bear in mind, imagine if somebody was reading Let Them Go for the first time and was only vaguely aware that it was part of a series. It leaves you with the sense of what next? And I think that's cleverly and intentionally done. If either of those sisters dies at the end, you finish with a sense of this book is over, close it. And you might not even think to look for part two, but the way it finishes, you think, well, that's a strange way to finish. What comes after that? I think that's one reason to do it. Coming of age is a massive theme of Alex's writing in every character, everything, every sort of arc he does. But he's a big believer in people starting out and from one place and finishing in a place where they found themselves, found their reason to be, or found their great love. This is Rebecca coming of age. The fact that she doesn't kill her, it's like for her entire life, she's done what she feels she has to. It's like she swam against the current for her entire life. And in that moment, the current is telling her what must be done here. It says, as he says the words, every fiber of my being said that this must be done. I must kill her for the sake of other people she might hurt, for the sake of she might come after, she might hurt me. And it's like for the first time in her life, she stops swimming and goes, no, I'm not going to go. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to choose a different path. That's a massive like release for her, I think, in terms of catharsis. I was going to say, I find it a tragedy that in terms of swimming against the current, Rebecca turned down her big chance of happiness with Rafe, refused his offer of marriage just to keep her shop. And we're watching this in flashback. We already know that she's going to lose the shop anyway, because the second her mother dies, her father's going to just give it away. So when we're listening or reading this in flashback, we can see the pain in this. I was almost screaming at her, no, don't sacrifice your own happiness for the sake of this shot, because you're going to lose it anyway. And then finally, and at the end, it finally doesn't matter anymore. It's almost a happy ending. And just to finish that point, I know I promised I wouldn't wax lyrical too much about Evil Dead, but the very last scene of Let Them Go, and Alex will no doubt smile when he hears me say this, because he's heard me rant on about Evil Dead, it finishes with this sudden relax, outpouring of tension. Oh, and it comes as the dawn comes and the light spills over the horizon, over the trees, over the two sisters. And that is exactly how Evil Dead finishes. And I find it's such a relief. And that is Rebecca finally going, I am free of all of this. I'm free of the pressures of marriage. I'm free of the shop. I'm free of the pressures of property and the pressures of expectation. And finally, whatever happens now, once I cross this stream stepping backwards, I am free moving forwards. I found it a happy ending.
Yeah.
Magnificent.
I mean, I can get on board with that. And the important thing, I think, is that we actually finally get to see a piece of that happy ending. Well, not quite a happy ending, because it's my favorite quote ever says, there are no happy endings because nothing ends.
Yeah.
But there is a form of a happy ending when we finally meet Agent Wolf in Steamheart and we realize, oh, right, you were hinting that this was Rebecca the whole time because her last name is Wolverton. and her dog is named Rafe. And you're just like, oh, the pain, the glorious pain.
Yes, but, of course.
I mean, both of them were good boys, so, you know.
Yeah. And the Burgess have orange eyes, which as do wolves.
Do they? I thought that wolves have...
Well, definitely yellow, aren't they? Yellowy orange?
I thought that they had different colored eyes, just like most mammals do, but as someone that loves wolves, I actually don't know.
I could be making that up.
Yeah.
To the Google. There is a... Yes, there is a sort of yellow orangish tint to the wolf eyes I am seeing. You can have sort of pale blue ones that look very
icy cold,
yeah, but which would be an interesting variant of the Wendigo if we ever see that. But I can see the comparison there.
Yeah, for me. And something we haven't said, we've talked about Rebecca backing away from killing Amanda. That works two ways. And I was fascinated by the fact that Amanda backs away as well. I'd like to put it to you guys. Was that a bit of leftover memory that she still remembers being Amanda at this point? Was that an indication that there is some semblance of the original person they used to be that's left over after they turn that might crop up later in the series? Was it the Barghast itself that is showing a bit more reason than we thought it was capable of? What do you think is behind Amanda backing away?
Well...
we both say, well.
we're trying to talk at once here. One of the things we talked about with Let Them Go in general is the uncertainty as regards to the supernatural is a big part of it, because it doesn't really come down one way or the other. It is left as an exercise to the reader or the listener to understand that better. And within the text of Let Them Go itself, we can't know one way or the other. We do know that Dawson, as he was making the change, he was able to be talked down by Rebecca at the last minute, back when he was first trying to break down the door. But Amanda was bitten first, so the change should have fully come over her by then, and therefore she should be completely one with the Barghast, and there should be nothing left of her previous life in there. The fact that there is the slightest inkling that there is more than just a raging beast, more than just a monster in there, could be interpreted as, you know, a flicker of hope in there, a flicker that she does remember something of her old life. But we don't know that for certain. What we do know isn't revealed until Secret Rooms, where we see all of the dead Wendigo in sort of family grouping, that they have starved to death rather than choose to feed on each other. And that lends itself more to these are wolves and therefore pack animals narrative rather than these are pure monsters. But even all the way through Steamheart at this point, we don't actually know what's going on in the Wendigo head. Even Seth, someone that the infection comes from, even if it's not the only place that it comes from, even he doesn't actually know what's going on in their heads. He has some means of influencing them or controlling them, but during that one part of Arlington where the Vox tube is recording him changing humans into Wendigo, he is studying the process himself. And he speaks to them even after they have seemingly lost all reason, and we don't know, because it's only vocal, whether they're doing exactly what he says or if they're just responding to their own instincts. And I feel like we're finally going to unpack that and find out the truth when we finally get to the phase two story, Wendigos.
Yeah, they certainly have a story coming, don't they?
I think it's just people sitting around a room talking about Wendigos, and by the end of it, they say, well, we don't know bloody anything more, do we? Nope, and it's the end of the book.
Meanwhile, the Wendigos are in another room going, well, they were a bit weird, weren't they?
Why are we speaking with a British accent? Are you a bar guest? No, I'm a bar...
I'm an American Wendigo.
Born and raised. To get back to your question, like Greg said, I think that it's deliberately presented with a certain amount of uncertainty because, as you say, Nick, this ending is meant to kind of encourage you to take a sprinting run forward into the rest of New Century, and to have a finality to it would run contrary to that. So to leave you with this lingering uncertainty, not only it sort of cements that feeling of I've got to learn more about these creatures, there's so much more to be discovered, it also, I think, connects with what is happening with Rebecca, that even though she's made the significant breakthrough, there is something about her where she can't bring herself to kill Rebecca. So it is this, she can't kill bring herself to kill Amanda, rather.
That's a great Freudian slip there, because one of the things we get into is that Amanda is representative of something in Rebecca, and if she kills Amanda, then she kills that part of herself.
Exactly. And I think that what I love about the staging of that final scene, it's one of my favorite scenes in all of New Century because it's so vivid and you can see every detail of it brought to life in your mind's eye, but it's that moment when she steps across the stream that is this lovely symbolic representation of crossing a threshold, of crossing something that delineates that she has finally left this part of her life, this old world behind. And it's symbolically the most appropriate thing for Amanda to have disappeared, because
I agree entirely.
At that point she has disappeared, she has taken that deliberate step, and it very much in the case of Samwise in the Fellowship of the Ring film, when he says, when I take one more step I'll have gone further from my home than I ever have before, it's that same moment of us taking that first step into a whole new world that's filled with Wendigos. So that would be a very different interpretation of the Aladdin's.
If I can fold an extra layer into what you just said.
Please do.
Just because I don't think you mentioned this, you touched upon it in one of your previous ones. I don't think you quite got to what I was going to say. The house itself, Ravenwood, was originally called Crowwood because it was named after the crossroads where highwaymen were hung. And that's referencing a very famous thing that crops up in a lot of, not just horror films. There's a movie called Crossroads with Ralph Macchio, who played the Karate Kid. The reference is this, about the blues musician Robert Johnson, who sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. I'm a big Supernatural fan, the TV show. It's in that a lot. The idea of the crossroads, where you decide your future and the devil is lurking at those crossroads to tempt you with things, to take the path that he wants, is a very big horror trope. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the original name for Ravenwood was Crowwood.
I actually wasn't sure if they were serious about that. I thought that that moment might have actually been in jest. So taking it in a serious light, I like that parallel that you're drawing there.
I like this idea that the whole story takes place on a crossroads where a decision is to be made on where this person's life goes. And is it going to go the devil's route or the angel's route?
And not to put so much emphasis on the title, because the story is more than its title, but I think that that's why the title Let Them Go is that call to action, that the right choice, or at least the choice that Rebecca makes at this crossroads, is to let them go. And that's what decides her, the path that she goes on.
Yeah, well, makes sense entirely. Yeah.
If you like ghost stories and you like stories about the crossroads, then I have to recommend I don't know if you've ever read any of Shannon McGuire's books, but there is one in particular. She loves supernatural stuff, and more specifically, urban fantasy. One of those urban fantasy series called Encrypted gets its own targeted spin-off, where it starts exploring the mythologies of ghosts and ghost stories. And one of those is specifically the Crossroads ghost, who is there to make deals for the Crossroads.
What's her name again?
The name of the author is Shannon McGuire, and the name of the book is Sparrow Hill Road. It's the first one, and it's actually a compilation of individual ghost story vignettes, but they are collected together in a nonlinear narrative because they all focus around one particular character, the hitchhiker ghost, and her experiences navigating the land of the living and the land of the dead.
Oh, I'm all about this. I'm looking at this.
I'm making a note of this now. It's going on my shopping list.
Excellent. Ooh, well, we're having a lot of fun here on Through the Wind Door. But before we put a pin in it, Nick, do you have anything else on your list of notes here that you'd like to bring up?
I do, a couple of things. At this point, I think some of them are kind of... I'll wrap up some loose ends that I missed. So, speaking about the mist, something else I found very interesting, I forgot to say at the time. It turns out the reason for the mist, the reason for the monsters, is a thing called the Arrowhead Project, which is a government attempt to open doors to other dimensions.
And it turns out
they've accidentally opened a door to dimensions that lets in monsters. So that was just drawing that other comparison with the New Century.
Yeah,
there's plenty of other little movie references I noticed in or horror referencing. My other favourite horror film, The Exorcist. You guys spoke about the view through the keyhole, looking at Amanda in the corner. That brought to mind the vision of Reagan in The Exorcist, of the possessed girl upstairs. And everyone else is downstairs discussing, not quite knowing what to do with her. And taking that to a wider view, not just in the Exorcist or horror films. Have you ever seen or read Jane Eyre before? I know you've mentioned it once or twice in the podcast.
I'm sure that I read it. I know that I read it in English, yeah. And I couldn't tell you a thing about it now.
Well, I was never a big fan of that, but I was a fan of... There's a book called Wild Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys, which is a... It's a feminist reaction to Jane Eyre, and that's fascinating. And it basically takes this idea of the crazy possessed person in the attic and goes, well, let's tell their story. How did they get there? How did they become crazy? Why are they in the attic? And it reminded me of that. Another thing I want to mention, the fact that that Cavendish in the first place has been released from Bodmin Asylum. Well, I don't know how close you are to British supernatural tales, but the Beast of Bodmin Moor is a famous one. There has apparently been a beast on Bodmin Moor for many, many years. Some will say it's some kind of cat or jaguar or something, but the idea of a beast loosed on Bodmin Moor is not a new one.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if Alex knows about that particular story, because his general way of entering the world is, why should one thing mean only one thing when it can mean 12?
12? That's very limited.
Something I complimented Alex on a long time ago, actually. He's very good at no one chapter, no one paragraph only does one thing. If he can write a sentence that achieves five different things at once, then all the better.
It made writing up my write-ups on each chapter, it took me a long while, because I was just going through sentence by sentence and just going, well, that's a note, well, that's a note, well, that's a note. Oh, crumbs, it's going to take me a whole day, isn't it?
Yeah, I found it fascinating, the whole thing with the passing the rifle as the, I think you guys mentioned Lord of the Flies as the passing of the token of leadership. And I thought, and how powerful it was that Dawson took the shotgun off Rebecca after she'd been passed it by Aunt Cleo. Very much a symbol of the patriarchy trying to reassert itself. I thought that was very fascinating. I had one little criticism. I challenged myself, actually. I think I said this to you, actually, Greg. I challenged myself to try and find a criticism, so I'm not just kissing Alex's ass too much.
We've been talking about that today.
I found it very, very hard, especially with this one. Especially, I found this one is just so tight and so lean and so hesitate to use the P word, but it's hard to find anything wrong with it. There's only one slight criticism I could possibly find on my second, well, listening to the story on the audiobook. I would have liked a little bit more seeding of the tension between Rebecca and Rafe, maybe an extra conversation or an extra scene, you know, just to seed the payoff that they've had the past relationship. I went back to watch Crimson Peak a second time, and when you watch Crimson Peak a second time, you can see that creepy friction between Hiddleston and Jessica Chastain, which you don't see the first time. And I think in Let Them Go, it would have been nice, just something to reward the ones that are really paying attention. A little bit more friction between Rebecca and Rafe, because I think it comes as such a surprise when you go, Oh wow! Oh crap! They know each other already. I think it would have been nice if that had been seeded a little bit more, but that is really nitpicking, because the book is pretty close to that P word.
Yeah, that's a good pick up of that, because I think that how it's sort of positioned in the story is it is meant to really take you by surprise and be a complete gut punch, because as soon as you put the pieces together, it makes a tragedy that has already happened so much worse. It just makes you really think about what Rebecca has lost and what can now never be. I think that surprise is quite important to kind of conceal that. But at the same time, I do see your point that they...
You've just reminded me of something. You've reminded me of an extra layer of tragedy that I'd even forgotten about myself until you said that. I don't think you've mentioned it either. So on top of the existing tragedy, then you fold in the layer of tragedy that they've had the background and that's now never going to happen. And then you have Amanda's notes when she says she's going to divorce him and leave and let Rebecca and Rafe be happy. So it could actually happen. I've just remembered that. Mm-hmm. It really is gutting, this one, isn't it?
Yeah, it hits you hard.
Yeah.
And I think it also has that, like, the reaction when I was re-listening to it and I was aware of what Rebecca and Rafe's previous relationship had been. Because beforehand, you just don't see any relationship there at all. And I think when you read it again, it feels like both Alex and Rebecca are kind of deliberately trying to avoid any impression whatsoever that they are anything more than passing acquaintances, because, this is my sister's husband. And I think that when the carriage arrives and Amanda greets Rafe, when you look at that scene again, you can see very deliberately that Rebecca kind of almost walks past Rafe without a second glance. And it's such a sort of British solution or approach to it, where it's just to kind of keep calm, carry on, and to completely ignore the trauma that's inside. It's something which feels like she's had to shut herself off from the emotions, because if she acknowledges it for even a moment, it will be too terrible for her to bear.
The thing that I've been watching a lot of recently is Downton Abbey. And Downton Abbey
is... A jolly good show.
It's a jolly good show, but it is so full of interpersonal drama and people hiding away their feelings for so many different reasons, whether you're talking about Lady Mary or talking about Anna and Mr. Bates. It never stops. There just ends up being a new level of it later on. And so that aspect of it that they get into so heavily in Downton Abbey is present in Let Them Go. It just, because it isn't given room to breathe, we had to do the deep dive on individual chapters, and some of the things I picked up on as being, I know where this is leading, and we can't talk about it, but some, I had completely forgotten that the moment with Amanda telling Rebecca to get out had actually been tied up in the final chapter of Let Them Go, but Toby knew, and he wasn't going to get into it. He wasn't going to spoil it for me. He said, we'll have a conversation about this after, but we didn't actually have that conversation. So by the time I was doing the outline for the final four chapters, that was where I realized, oh, that was tied up.
Yeah.
Well, we could even record a little sort of conversation on that point and insert it in there, and then no one but the three of us will know. Oh, shit, you're recording this, and everyone will now know.
It's fine. This is a fandom podcast. We're not trying to write our own fiction narrative here.
No. We're not trying to present any sort of narrative whatsoever. And may I personally apologize for the Wendigos you would have heard passing the window just moments ago.
No, I thought they were being well-behaved this time. They stiff upper British lip and all that.
Yeah, our bar guests wear top hats and monocles. It's very bizarre.
If we have any fanfic artists out there listening, I'd like to see this.
For all we know, Alex has already had Antonio Torresan do that for him, and he's just got it sitting in a folder somewhere, and he'll just throw it up as soon as he hears us talking about this and be like, wizard!
No, he'll say nothing, and that will be even more infuriating.
The Downtons of Wendigo or something.
Hey, you want to improve like a second pass of Downton Abbey? Just throw a few Wendigos in there, it'll be fine.
Well, I recently watched the Pride and Prejudice with Zombies thing. It could be done better. Just saying.
Yeah. Well, you said you saw the movie. You didn't necessarily read the book that it's based on.
No, I didn't read. No, I saw the movie. It was okay. It was watchable. Yeah. Watchable, but could be better.
I haven't seen either. I do like the joining together of two different contemporary story worlds to make an intriguing new combination. Obviously, the biggest one was the huge crossover that Alan Moore did with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But there was a separate one that I very much enjoyed that was positioned as a lost manuscript of Dr. John Watson. One of the conceits of the Sherlock Holmes mythos is that the stories of his mysteries saw the light of day because Watson chose to share them with the world. In the prologue to this novel, the author pulls a similar illusion as William Goldman, the author of The Princess Bride, positioning it as an actual story that was kept from being published as a real crime drama due to the wishes of Sherlock and others. The twist is that the novella reframes the narrative of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde to include Sherlock as the man hired to identify the truth behind Mr. Hyde. He basically comes in somewhere in the middle because Utterson hires Sherlock to look into the matter of Mr. Hyde and what control he has over Dr. Jekyll, and it makes for a compelling alternate history of these events. Very much enjoyed it. I forget who wrote it, but you can find it under Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Holmes.
Ah, I'll have to look that up. And yeah. This whole conversation is something that we'll have to bear in mind when we come to the Christmas Thieves, because that's very much doing exactly that. It's not only presenting an alternate version of, you know, A Christmas Carol, but actually one of Alex's own books with one of his characters where he thinks, oh, this character is such a piece of shit. But what if they weren't? And so I shan't say any more about that because I have it on good authority that at least one person here hasn't read it yet.
Oh, right. But
you don't want to spoil it for Ned. Don't spoil the retelling of A Christmas Carol.
I like the Muppets Christmas Carol, if that spoils anything.
No, we could never beat the Muppets, dear boy.
Here's the thing. We have to say that the Muppets are an official part of the new century canon. Like, can we just acknowledge that?
How would we go about doing that? Will we now have to include a 12th world where the Muppets came through?
We've never seen like an official picture of the Wendigos. We actually, like, there's a stinger at the end of one of the written books where we finally get a picture and it's just Animal from the Muppets
or Sweetums. The Wendigo Sweetums all along. We're coming up a little bit on our pumpkin date here. So
cool.
If there's anything left in your notes, Nick, let's please get to it.
Just very quickly, I have one thing to say on the names. You ever mentioned that they're called Barghast in this, they're called Wendigos in some of the other stories. I found that really, again, fascinating. And admirable is the phrase, because I don't think I've seen that done before. You know, like the idea that these monsters have different names in every book, every story. I think that's quite original. I think that's an admirable touch from Alex. You guys discussed about names giving power or taking power away. You know, they have like Harry Potter and the power in the Voldemort name. Never ending stories all about the kid naming his mum at the end. They're called Walkers in The Walking Dead. I found it very creatively rewarding that, of course, they've got different names. They're not just going to be called zombies or walkers or whatever. I thought that was a very good touch. And then finally, I liked Alex's twist on, if you're into horror as much as I have been recently, there's something that was a trope that has then become slightly more than that, called The Final Girl. Carol Clover invented it. Her book's called Men, Women and Chainsaws, Gender in the Modern Film. And it used to be very much a weakness in horror films to end on this, for some reason, this one girl survives the movie and everyone else dies. And in recent years, or in the last, I'd say 10 or 15 years, it's gone from being quite a sexist and quite a derivative, quite a boring, lazy way to finish a film. It's become a thing of empowerment. They do it in the Evil Dead one that I love so much. And they do it very much so in Let Them Go. It's like an inversion of this final girl trope with Rebecca finishing the way she does in this position of strength. And I saved that till the end. I think it's a nice way to finish.
Yeah.
We do bring up Ellen Ripley again and again in our Let Them Go conversation. Not just because the pose for the cover is very Ellen suiting up to go find Newt. Not just because Rebecca and Amanda are named after Ellen Ripley's two children. Ellen Ripley is not the traditional final girl, but one of the progenitors of the ascension of that trope. Because the final girl is also often the one that was talking sense from the beginning, and if they had paid attention to her, then all of this tragedy wouldn't have happened. There are elements of that where she is trying to lead Dawson onto the right track after things have gone to pot. But there are also elements of that.
No, Potts is in a different book.
There are elements of that where she is talking to Dawson before they even get to Ravenwood and saying, why do we need to do this at all? There are better ways to go about doing this.
Yes, of course there are. And she's, and they have this whole big argument, and Dawson just keeps saying, no. Of course, listen to her in the first place. I'd forgotten that, mother.
Yeah. I do now have a greater appreciation for the empowering nature of the final girl archetype in the horror genre, looking back on it with more modern sensibilities. But by the same token, it's one of the very few ways that women are allowed to exist in fictional narratives, which is part of the reason why I and so many others enjoy Fury Road as much as we do, because it finally introduces a new kind of female protagonist that isn't any of the established canon ways that it's permissible to have a woman in a violent context, the avenging feminine. So if you have not seen the 8-part video essay on YouTube by Innuendo Studios about the avenging feminine, I highly recommend that. I'll put a link up to that in the doobly-doo when I post this to the podcast website.
Well, you two are just filling my read list and watch list this evening.
Yeah, I thought I already pointed you at the series done by Innuendo Studios, but maybe I did that for somebody else. I don't remember now.
Well, if you have, I apologize for not doing so sooner. But
maybe it was something that came up in passing pre-recording one of the podcasts. Nick, any last cappers?
No, that's me done this time. The first time you said, right, we're getting to the end of this now. Nick, any more thoughts? I'm like, oh, man, I've still got pages full. But now we're actually at the end.
All right. Well, Nick, thank you very much for coming on to Through the Wind Door with us. This has been a delight on multiple levels. It's given us meat to chew on. It's given us room to talk about the thing that we love and many other instances of horror and supernatural fiction. If there comes a point in the future where you would like to talk some more about later novels that you want to bring something to, we'd love to have you back. There's no reason we can't continue to have you and more guests on as extras for everyone to enjoy.
Yeah, you're always welcome back.
Thank you very much. That means a lot. This is my second podcast. The first one was the one with Alex, and this is, yeah, so I'm still very new to it, but enjoying every chance I can get to, you know, talk with like-minded people and people who share the same passions and interests, which you guys clearly do. But so thank you very much for inviting me. It's been wonderful.
Listeners, we will see you all next time, or talk to you next time, on another trip through the wind door. Bye-bye.
Take care.
And as a closer, I'm going to steal another page from Alex's book. When I originally started crafting the framework for Through the Wind Door, I went and picked out specific tracks that I thought would work well for an intro and outro, like I had heard other podcasts do. I'm still particularly proud of the eponymous outro that I picked for the main episodes, as it came from an album titled Multiverse. But to celebrate our first White Scars team-up, let me share with you one of my favorite team-up themed songs by the band Kongos.
Come with me now. Come with me now. Afraid to lose control and caught up in this world. I've wasted time, I've wasted breath. I think I've thought myself to death. I was born without this fear. Now only this seems clear. I need to move, I need to fight. I need to lose myself tonight.
Walk with me now.
I move with my head, I open my mouth and it's something I've read. I've stood at this door before I'm told, but a part of me knows that I'm growing too old. Confused what I thought was something I felt. Confused what I feel was something that's real. I tried to sell my soul last night. Funny, you wouldn't even tell.